And welcome back to another Cinema Vino. Sean Jordan's here with me.
Hola.
And we're going to continue our look at the Oscar and Golden Globe award season with looking at Being the Ricardos, which is acclaimed director, writer-director Aaron Sorkin's latest film.
He hasn't directed a lot, right? He mostly writes?
He is very much a writer. He's gotten into directing lately in the last few years. But, you know, as a writer, he did The West Wing, Sport Tonight, Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, which only lasted, I believe, two seasons.
Yeah, I think that's what surprised me, because I'm used to him being, like, a writer, and he's a really well-known writer.
Yeah.
But he directed this, which I thought he did a really good job.
Yeah. And then he wrote The Newsroom, but also film-wise, Social Network, Moneyball.
Yeah.
And I just went blank. He's done quite a few films.
Which seems like he does a lot of good, like, people stories.
Yeah.
Not necessarily all biopics. I mean, like, Moneyball is a biopic, sort of.
Yeah.
This is a biopic.
And I actually just watched part of Steve Jobs, the movie that he did with Fassbender, which I thought was really good. Seth Rogen was excellent as Wozniak in that. I don't think he was nominated for an Oscar, and he probably should have been.
Seth Rogen?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, he was that good in that.
I haven't seen him.
Yeah. Yeah,
I would recommend. If I have, it's been a long time.
One thing I'm learning more and more watching his movies is, and I you would have thought I would have picked this up because I've seen The West Wing and I've seen all of his TV stuff, but it's like, he's one of those writers, you either love him or you get kind of turned off by him. Very, very distinct. It's like, in movies they have the theory of the auteur, which says that the director puts his personality on something, you know, indelibly. Sorkin's the writing equivalent of that. His personality is all over everything he writes. You can't miss it.
Well, and I think with him directing, that really doubles down, because then he's not just putting the words on the paper that, you know, is his personality. He's also directing his personality into the movie.
Total control.
Yeah.
It's the Orson Welles.
Which scenario. Could be, I mean, we talked about this. This movie did not get great reviews.
No.
I think it's like a 6.6 on IMDb.
Something like that.
Which seems
low.
Low.
To me.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would say that the movie, just to give a little background on it, it explores basically, the narrative jumps around, but it explores basically a week in the life of Lucille Ball, Desi Arnaz, during the peak of I Love Lucy.
Specifically, the week where Lucy was brought up in the tabloids. Well, Desi and Lucy were both brought up in the tabloids for their relationship, and also for Lucy potentially being a communist.
Yeah. It's like this is also the peak of the HUAC.
The Red Scare.
Yeah. The McCarthy sort of Inquisition witch hunt kind of a thing, which infected all over Hollywood.
Yeah, it was mostly precipitated in Hollywood, where they thought people were trying to be overly influential about, you know, communist politics and being a bunch of commies.
And it was exactly the way they just depicted in this movie, where it's like, if somebody had, you know, checked a box 20 years ago, 25 years ago, or, you know, somebody's spouse went to a meeting one time, they were suspect, you know. It's paranoia at its peak.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Lucille Ball, America's sweetheart, wasn't immune to that. But,
you know, obviously the movie gets into it more, but with Desi Arnaz being a Cuban expat, and, you know, this being past the Cuban, you know, revolution and everything, he was someone who was seen as, you know, an all-American, and he was not communist sympathizer at all. So
yeah,
I think that played a big part into it as well.
Yeah. Yeah. He definitely wanted to be seen as a gung-ho American who, you know, fought for the Americans in World War II, yada, yada. I mean, he wanted to make it clear that he was very much an American citizen. And I think publicly was thought of that way. I mean, obviously his accent's unmistakable, but Lucy and Ricky were kind of the all-American couple, you know?
Well, and I don't know how much of that happened as a result of the show versus how much of that was, because obviously he was famous prior to the show.
Yeah.
But we get to see in this movie kind of that personality evolve and kind of see their stardom evolve as a power couple, sort of, you know?
And you also kind of get to see the beginning of their end, you know? It's like you get to see the beginning of them becoming a power couple, but you also see how that power is going to come to an end eventually.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they kind of can't get out of their own way. Lucille Ball is played by Nicole Kidman. And
who was not the original casting for this. I think it was Jessica Chastain.
I've heard Jessica Chastain. I've heard Deborah Messing. from Will and Grace was also on the list of people.
Yep, I heard that too.
And there was some controversy about that they didn't feel Nicole Kidman looked exactly right for Lucille Ball.
Which, no one's gonna be a one for one.
No.
But I thought they did a really good job of like really just keeping her hair like in the Lucille Ball like mm-hmm. tight coif. I don't know if you want to call it a coif, but I thought it was coifish.
Yeah. And she had that
coifish.
Quaffish?
Quaffish?
I think it's quaffish.
Oh, I mean, which, coifish is what you have in a pond.
And crawfish is what you have in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. Although sometimes it's referred to as crayfish, I'm told.
Oh, huh. Also crawdads.
Here in Oklahoma.
Let's talk about crawdads.
Yeah. We need like a 5-minute aside about like getting crawdads out of creeks.
You mean crayfish out of creeks?
Yeah. Oh yeah, being in the Ricardos. So, you know, I did not think that Nicole Kidman necessarily had a strong resemblance to Lucille Ball, but did a very good job of them.
Strong resemblance.
No, she was a unique individual. She really was, both in mannerisms and.
Well, and Javier Bardem was by no means a shoe-in for Desi Arnaz.
No, but again, he had that sort of, you know, freewheeling charisma that Desi Arnaz had. I mean, he was like this outsized personality, and mm-hmm. I thought Javier Bardem did a really good job of that.
I don't know that I necessarily always think of Javier Bardem as like a big outsized personality. I usually think of him as more reserved, kind of quiet mm-hmm. and like a deep river, you know,
yeah,
slow rivers run deep kind of guy. But yeah. Desi Arnaz was very much like a big, flirtatious, like mm-hmm. loud,
very outgoing individual.
Yeah, yeah. Very outspoken. Like, yeah, he's a performer. He's a musician.
Mm-hmm. Band leader even.
Yeah. I don't see that with Javier Bardem, but he played it really well.
Yeah. It's like, you know, Desi wasn't, I mean, because yeah, with the band leader, it's like you are literally like the personality of the band in front of it. But you're basically the liaison with the crowd.
Yeah.
And so you kind of have to embody the spirit of the music. And so, you know, I thought that Javier did a good job of, you know, embodying Ricky in that sense.
Yeah. And he played guitar really well. He played the drums really well. I think his physical performance and musical performance was really spot on for that character.
Both of them.
Yeah.
I thought it was a little weird because, I mean, I grew up watching I Love Lucy on like Nick at Night, and it was on reruns during the day. So it was one of those shows I found occasionally. It was like one of those classic, like, you know, Andy Griffith kind of things where it's like I went through a spell of watching Twilight Zone.
Yeah. It was like it was on TV Land all the time, and it was on Nick at Night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it was probably the first like landmark sitcom to come about.
Yeah. You know, like, I definitely remember watching I Love Lucy and Happy Days.
Yeah. Which Happy Days is the homage to that time period. You know, it's the 70s, like, look back at the 50s. By the 70s, the 50s were already nostalgia, which is crazy to think about. Yeah. And so...
Those were the days.
They must have been. But yeah, it was like, you know, I Love Lucy was the first big milestone sitcom. And Lucille Ball, you could argue, was the first true icon of TV. And I mean, Desi Arnaz too, but definitely Lucy.
Well, and they were talking about like some of the numbers, you know, at the very beginning, they're talking about the size and the scale of how big I Love Lucy was in the American household. And mm-hmm. they were saying at one point, you know, you think of like the Super Bowl, you think of, you know, things that hit like number one, like can't like the finales of certain shows. And it's like 10 million, 15 million. Like yeah. It's crazy number of people watching. And they're like, I Love Lucy got like 60 million people watching at the same time.
Regularly.
And granted, there were like four channels back then, mm-hmm. but it was true that like this was the landmark show for television where yeah. when you see in the movie, CBS approaches Lucille Ball, she's kind of like, television? I'm on radio.
Yeah, which was still the big deal at the time, you know, post-World War II. TV was very much a burgeoning thing.
Yeah.
But it's like, that's an interesting thing. That's an undercurrent of this movie is how technology and the modern era, the internet and all 24-hour TV is kind of diluted fame.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Because, yeah, I mean, you would have 70% of the TVs in the country tuned to I Love Lucy, 75, you know, of every TV in this country that everybody that owned a TV would be watching that show.
Well, there's so much more noise now that shows have to cut through. I mean, you know, every now and then we have shows that kind of strike a chord in the American zeitgeist where it's like, Game of Thrones was really big. Mm-hmm. Like Lost, I guess, was really big.
Yeah, but even those, I mean, it's like,
but those pale in comparison to what I Love Lucy was, because they didn't have as much to cut through. I mean, mm-hmm. they had four other shows that they'd compete with, and mm-hmm. they could broadcast nationwide.
Yeah.
So,
well, and it's like TV wasn't even a 24-hour enterprise then, and it really wasn't until
TV turned off at like 8 p.m.
Yeah.
It's like 8 p.m. It's like, all right, we're going off the air. Here's the American, like, here's the national anthem.
Yeah. I can remember as a kid being late at night, turning on the TV and seeing the color bars and tone, you know, like where it was just like the screen.
Yeah.
You know,
they, I can't, but.
Yeah. A little older, but it's like, I can remember that from, you know, that's probably, I would say early 90s. I can remember that happening where it's like you could turn on one of the stations and they would be dead.
Yeah.
It's dead air. You never see that now.
Oh, no. I mean, it might be like a MyPillow infomercial, but like fucking Vince from Slap Chop.
Yeah, you might be down the rabbit hole somewhere.
Yeah. And, you know, that's just the nature of things is there's no such thing as free real estate anymore.
Yeah.
But I think it was really cool to see they did a good job of capturing not just the story, but capturing the times of the entertainment and how they were showing like the advent of a new era of, you know, the silver screen, you know,
and kind of that first moment of pushing the boundaries of censorship, free speech. It's like, that was a huge deal to show a pregnancy on TV. We're still in separate beds for married couples.
Yep.
You know, that sort of Donna Reed, My Two Sons kind of thing. There's still couples sleeping in two beds.
Well, and having to pass it by, you know, the sponsors, which was, you know, cigarette company and who else? I don't know.
Yeah, it was Philip Morris, which is like, you know, I guess the tobacco companies have the market cornered on morality.
Yeah.
At that time period.
Yeah. They're like, oh, we're a cigarette company. We're not going to be associated with a pregnant woman on television.
Yeah. I mean, even though this couple is married, happily married.
Kids are going to ask questions.
It's like they're going to picture, you know, Ricky and Lucy doing it. You know, it's like, well, how the hell else do people think babies? And they bring this point up in the movie. It's like, where do you think babies are coming from?
Yeah.
But, I don't think they mentioned it in the movie, but it was like they ultimately, Lucy was allowed to be pregnant. But they were not allowed to use the word pregnant.
Did they say like with child?
Expecting.
Okay.
She's not pregnant. She's expecting, which they made jokes out of, you know, Desi, he couldn't say that. So he just said spectin'. So.
Well, and I also like that they really shined a light on the writing room and the intersection of the writing room mm-hmm. with the actors and with the production.
And with the sponsors and the executives and on and on.
Yeah.
You know, obviously Desi and Lucy's instincts were right because of the birth of Ricky Jr. on I Love Lucy was one of those moments where everybody was watching it. Like it was nationwide. Mm-hmm. One of the most watched TV episodes of the 50s was when Ricky Jr. is born.
Wow.
So, you know, and I don't know if they really depict that, but it's like, it shows you how right they were and how in tune they were with what the public wanted.
Yeah. And it seemed like, Sorkin did a really good job of writing just enough of their history to kind of bring you up to speed, but not so much that it's a story of like everything coming up to it. They really focused on this one week of production and then everything after that, they just, they only gave like one, epilogue note.
Yeah.
And, I thought that was really cool.
Yeah.
So the week of, I loved seeing, and I don't know how accurate it is. I mean, they didn't even get, those weren't even the real people they were interviewing. Those were actors portraying the people mm-hmm. that they were pretending to be.
Yeah.
And like, I just thought it was so cool to see what the production process was like. They did the table read on Monday and then there's just writing and tweaking and writing and tweaking. And there's,
which is still how it is.
Yeah. Well, and seeing, Lucille Ball's like involvement with it, seeing how, you know, she would be in the writer's room. She would like think like, that doesn't make sense for my character. She was obviously very controlling of, you know, what makes sense for Lucy.
Her instincts were next level.
Uh-huh.
Because it was like, you know, they're talking about the grape scene, which is maybe the most iconic scene in I Love Lucy.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, she hears it and knows that when they're pitching it, it's not quite right. And so she takes it to the next level when it's like, oh, I dropped my wedding ring in the vat. And now I have to get down in the grape slop and find it.
Yeah.
So she had those kind of next level abilities to take something to make it funnier, make it better.
And at one point, you know, Desi says to her, You have there's no real, I can't think of the word in English. You have kinetic.
Kinetic energy.
Yeah, you have like kinetic power. Like you're just like kinetically gifted.
Yes, and very true.
Yeah,
some people just have that.
She had great physical comedy, and seeing her interactions with J.K. Simmons' character, who he was like, I did vaudeville for 40 years. You think I don't know what I'm doing with my elbows?
It's muscle memory for him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, which J.K. Simmons, amazing.
Phenomenal.
He was so good in this.
Yeah. And that's such a complicated part because William Frawley and Vivian Vance, who played Fred and Ethel Mertz, obviously they depicted it there where they hated each other behind the scenes. They were bitter enemies on that set.
They had some great fucking zingers.
Yeah. And they did a good job of portraying that. One thing that struck me was Vivian Vance talking about how, you know, the undercurrent was that she lost too much weight, that she was too pretty, that the outfits were too revealing, that she was not necessarily intentionally, but upstaging Lucy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with the passing of Betty White, we've been rewatching some Golden Girls
lately. R.I.P.
Yeah. And the one thing that struck me about that, I thought about that, where Vivian, in that week, it gets to Vivian, like the fact that one of the themes of I Love Lucy between Fred and Ethel was that she's not pretty enough for him. That's one of his jokes throughout the show. She's not pretty enough for him.
She was a punchline.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's not a good enough wife. She doesn't cook. Her cooking's terrible. You know, cleaning's terrible. She's not good company to him. She's not pretty. She doesn't try to be pretty. And I guess during that week, that just got to Vivian Vance. And I thought about that watching Golden Girls, where it's like Bea Arthur is that in that show. She is the constant, like, they make jokes about her height. They make jokes about how she dresses.
She's very tall.
Yes. During the episode where it's kind of goofy, but Betty White's character writes a letter to Gorbachev, the Russian premier. And Gorbachev wants to come and meet her because he thinks that she has to be 6 years old and wants to come and shake her hand for writing such a nice letter. Well, Rose imagines meeting him in front of a massive crowd at the Kremlin. And when Dorothy takes the stage, people start chanting Brezhnev, who Brezhnev was another premier who, not a handsome man, but they're basically saying that Dorothy looked like an ugly Russian man. And it's like, I think about that. It's like, poor Dorothy, you know, poor Bea Arthur having to like listen to that, you know?
But you got to think Golden Girls was a little bit different because there was no like sex symbol.
No.
I mean, obviously you had Blanche.
Yeah.
Obviously. But like they were, the entire point of the show was like, you guys are old, you're old people. Mm-hmm. You're like, we're going to follow you around your old ladies.
Yeah.
Like,
what's going to bake your noodle about that is that at the start of that show, those women were probably in the mid to late 50s. Mm-hmm. And the women in the current Sex and the City reboot are older.
Wow.
Yeah.
Really?
Their average age, not counting obviously Estelle Getty. Her character's supposed to be 80-something, but like, you know, Rose and Blanche.
Well, and Estelle, the actress who played Estelle, was the youngest one on The Golden Girls.
Yeah, she was chronologically, like, in real life, the youngest, but her character was the oldest.
Yeah.
I think at the beginning of it, Blanche is supposed to be like 53, something like that. Dorothy's supposed to be like, you know, mid-50s.
I love this fun fact. That's fun.
And the Sex and the City crowd, they're pushing 60. So they are older than
we've really come a long way.
Yeah. And it's like, you look at that. That was Golden Girls season one. They're pitched as older women. I mean, just like,
oh yeah,
over
yeah,
the hill, yeah. You know?
I mean, they're called Golden Girls because they're like in their golden
years, yeah, in their 50s.
Golden years.
So it's interesting that it's like David Bowie. But to see that, how much that's changed.
Yeah.
I know we're getting off track here, but
we are getting way off track.
Back to the original point. I think about that watching these episodes of Dorothy, how her character takes a beating. It's like, you know, with Rose, Betty White, they knock her for her brains, and Blanche is a tramp, and Sophia is
Cena. Yeah, but that's writing, you know, like being a hussy or being like,
yeah,
you know, not smart. That's writing.
It's but sharp.
If they're making fun of your looks,
yeah,
that's you as an actor.
Yeah.
You know, and I think for the character in I Love Lucy is like that. You can't not feel personal.
Yeah.
You know?
And that's kind of what Vivian Vance says, where it's like, you know, this week it got to me, you know? And it's like, you had to imagine that, those kind of things where it's like, you know, we can't have you be too pretty. You know, you're losing weight.
The women want to look and see someone like them on TV.
Mm-hmm. And so in a very underhanded moment, you know, Lucy sends up more food to Vivian's dressing room,
yeah,
to try and like have her bulk back up. Interesting little bit of backstage drama.
Uh-huh.
There was a lot of little interesting moments like that of, you know, kind of that sort of corridor drama that was going on behind everything. So,
well, and like J.K. Simmons' character, you know, being a drunk, mm-hmm. but not being drunk.
Yeah.
You know, he's like, you know, I thought you weren't supposed to drink during the day. And he's like, no, I'm not supposed to be drunk during the day. If you were drunk, would I know?
Nope. Yeah, key difference. But yeah, I don't believe that that actor lived a whole lot longer after the show.
No, I don't think so.
For that reason, I believe he was an alcoholic.
Yeah.
But he pulled it together long enough.
Who wasn't back then? Those were the days.
And it's interesting because, like they say in this movie, Ricky / Desi was younger than Lucille Ball by mm-hmm. several years.
Yeah.
But then Fred Mertz was 20 plus years, maybe 25 years older than Ethel. She says that, like, you know, Lucy's dating a younger man. Meanwhile, I'm dating my grandpa.
Yeah.
You know, it's just weird, that dynamic. Yeah. But still, it's like her as a character, she's not good enough for this old man who was in his 70s.
Yeah.
So, crazy.
But you also got to think, you know, you're the biggest, like, you're on the biggest show. You're the, you know, number two, you're basically the number two couple, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. Like,
there's not that many more actors in I Love Lucy.
No.
So,
and it kind of points out like how sometimes it sucks to be the couple behind the couple even more, you know, to be the, basically the understudies in them, you know, because obviously, you know, Lucy and Ricky as characters do no wrong. It's like Fred and Ethel, the comic relief. It's
do
like,
all wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're the characters who get the ugliest and snarkiest with each other.
Yep.
So sometimes they have the tougher job. It's like they draw the laughs, but they also like take the abuse from the writers the most. So.
There was one line that J.K. Simmons had during the table read that I just fucking laughed out loud at, where one of the writers was just like, oh, we're just throwing casual insults now. And he just goes, I'm sorry if I'm not dressing up my fucking insults in a tuxedo for you.
Very Aaron Sorkin.
That's so good.
Yeah. Yeah, there's some sharp lines.
The sharp lines definitely feel very Sorkin-y.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, that's the one part where like it felt like a Sorkin movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it was delivered well. I thought it was really well written and directed. It was very seamless.
Yeah.
What do you think of Nicole Kidman's acting? If that's like why we're here. She was nominated for Best Actress, right?
And won for, Best Actress in a Drama. So I'd say that makes her the front runner for, you know, the Oscar.
Yeah.
And great. You know, I mean, like I say, it's impossible to really, truly like mimic Lucille Ball, but she
put on a Lucille Ball voice when she was doing Lucy.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how accurate that was, but it felt like she was
very accurate. I thought
normal Lucille Ball. Mm-hmm. But then when she was Lucy, she did the Lucy voice.
Yeah.
You know,
and they make that point in the writer's room. I forget the name of it. It's a famous sitcom writer played by Aaliyah Shawkat from Arrested Development.
Uh-huh.
But it's like how they dumb her down so much. They make her into a little kid sometimes.
She's like, I'm the only one in this room trying to make Lucy smart.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, where she does the wham, throws a fit like a little kid, mm-hmm. you know, but it's like, you know, Lucy, it's like, that's one thing you have to, as Lucy, swallow it, where it's like, well, it gets the laughs, you know,
yeah.
And I guess as a comedian, sometimes you just have to surrender to what's funny. So love it or hate it. It's like the bickering about the scene where Ricky comes in to surprise her and throws out all these fake names. It's like, logically, it doesn't make any sense, but it gets the laugh. So
yeah, she's like, you're telling me that we are saying that Desi genuinely believes that Lucy thinks that there are all these men coming in and out of the apartment.
Yeah.
And they're just like, it's the suspension of disbelief. Like, just go with it.
Yeah.
She's like, no, I'm telling you, that does not make sense. But they ended up going with that cut.
Yeah.
So
Tony Hale was great.
He was. Well, and it was, I think, is this the first reunion of Tony Hale with
Aaliyah Shawkat? First, I mean, since Arrested Development.
Since Arrested Development.
Yeah. That's weird to see them like
all grown up.
Yeah. That's just crazy.
Yeah.
Buster and maybe Funke.
Yeah.
And she was great too. You know?
She was really good. Yeah.
Yeah.
I love her as an actress. I've seen her in a lot of other things.
It's like her character and Lucy really bond about the fact that they're women in a sexist time and they're the smartest people in the room.
Yeah.
Even though their ideas sometimes have trouble finding the light of day, mm-hmm. you know, which is interesting.
Well, and I thought, you know, the storyline of Desi that runs through this is that he is cheating.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying that he's not.
Yeah.
It was put out into a publication that, you know, had an old picture, showed him, had a story about how he was, you know, up all night with somebody else, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So that's the story that kind of runs through this, but there's also the story of their production working together and how he was a producer, but he wasn't credited as a producer.
Mm-hmm.
And J.K. Simmons kind of pulls, you know, Lucy aside and says, like, you need to let everybody know that he's running the show.
Yeah.
Like, give him. He has that machismo of, you know, an old school Cuban. Like, you need to give him, you know, some credit where credit is due.
Yeah.
And so seeing that dynamic kind of play out, in which she was a powerhouse in that room.
Yeah.
But so was he, but he was a quieter powerhouse.
And he would defer to her a lot.
Yeah.
And want her to take that spotlight. And it's a great scene where Tony Hill's character Oppenheimer tries to flatter Desi. And it's like, you're the one who loves Lucy, you know.
You're the title character. Yeah. You're who loves Lucy.
Of course, he's way too smart to fall for that and gets seriously offended.
If you ever try to do that again, I will reach down your throat and pull your stomach in.
Which feels like an extremely out of character, you know, Desi Arnaz moment. But yeah, the whole cast was great. I thought all the actors were amazing.
They were. It was really well cast. And it's a great cast too. Like, tons of recognizable faces.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just even some minor characters, like just some of the, you know, marketing guys that were in the room was from CBS.
Yeah.
Like, those are recognizable faces. Like, the guy who played Coulson.
Clark Gregg. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he was in there.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it was a really great cast. Really well done.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed it a lot.
1 out of 10, what would you give it?
I'd give it an 8.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Me too. I think I was 4 out of 5 stars, so yeah.
Yeah, it's right there.
Yeah. It was a debate between 7 and 8, and it was a classic deal where I'm writing the review, and I liked it with everything I was saying. Like, I really enjoyed this movie. So.
Yeah, I mean, I can, you know, nitpick, you know, a star off, but I don't really want to. I think 8 is an appropriate score. I think it's right there.
If it got nominated for Best Picture, it wouldn't piss me off.
Yeah, I mean, I'll probably, you know, I would watch it again maybe a year from now.
Yeah.
It's not something I want to immediately turn around, like, rewatch and, you know, redigest all over again. Yeah. But
I don't think it will win Best Picture, but it could definitely be one of the nominees.
No, I mean, we'll see.
Yeah. As for wine, we're currently drinking the Lenore Syrah, Washington State. So this is a favorite of mine. It's kind of a zesty, kind of peppery wine, I think. It's got some spice to it.
It does have spice to it.
You know. So definitely matches the Lucy Ricky dynamic, I think.
Lucy.
If you're watching something with Lucy and Desi, you need something that's got some kick.
Lenore.
So you need something that's got that power to it. And so I think that this Syrah from Washington, from the Columbia Valley, will hold up really well. It's big, fruity, but you get those kind of nice, more dried fruits to it. It's full body enough. You could do it with a steak. You know, you could do it with a big meal.
This would be great with steak.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really any kind of grill food. You know, it's adaptable. You could do a lot with this. You could even do it with, like, chicken, stuff like that, fried chicken.
Mm-hmm.
I think it'd be great with that. So, pretty versatile. And yeah, it's like $20. So, if you're looking for something good, Lenore, Washington State, it's a great, great little red wine. So, this has been another episode of Cinema Vino. And next time we're going to take a look at the tragedy of Macbeth. Denzel Washington's collaboration with Joel Cohen. So we're going to get a little Shakespearean, which I'm looking forward to.
Yeah.
This will be a
little Shakespeare.
Yeah. And then we're going to get into rom-coms next month. Those are going to be audience-picked rom-coms, which sounds like just a barrel of monkeys. So
if you have a suggestion for what you want us to watch rom-com-wise, let us know on Instagram. We're going to take some suggestions there. We'll draw from a hat and figure out what we're going to watch.
At Cinema Vino Podcast, where you want to head.
Yep.
Or Cinema Vino on Facebook. So either way, track us down.
Come find us.
Let us know, and we will get on that. So this has been another episode, and we thank you all very much. Sean Jordan.
Muchas gracias.
My name is Todd, and we will see you guys very soon.
See ya. Be sure to listen, rate, and subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Our website is at cinemavino.net, and reviews of these movies can be found at toddwoffordmovies.com.
If you're interested in starting your very own podcast, Blueberry is one of the top hosting companies in the world. You can get your first month free with Blueberry by using the promo code CINEMAVINO. You can also use the hosting estimator on their site to determine the best plan for you. And don't forget, that's CINEMAVINO to get your first month free.